Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We're going to move on to opioid epidemic now, and it seems as though every day there is some news about the opioid crisis in America. New Columbia study, you heard during the news that survivors of an opioid overdose may consider themselves lucky, but they remained at heightened risk of dying from a host of medical problems. Columbia University says the so-called, in quotation marks, lucky ones were also 45 times more likely to die of HIV, 40 more times more likely to die of chronic respiratory diseases, and nearly 30 times more likely to die of viral hepatitis, and the risk of suicide was 25 times greater. And unless you think this is something that's happening in the back alleys, I think the opioid crisis primarily affects people that are white. And the other thing I would bring up is a new thing in Louisiana whereby physicians are going to have to go to continuing education classes to learn more about opioid prescription before they can renew their license. Dr. Harry Gould joins us right now, professor of neurology and director of the Pain Mastery Program at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning, Tommy.
Thanks for taking the time. I hope you have a couple of minutes because I got a ton of questions.
Sure.
You know, some things become ubiquitous and everybody hears about opioid epidemic. But I think while we know of it, maybe we quite don't know enough about it. And I would ask you to go back a little bit to the history of this. And at what point did we have a sea change in this country between the way we dealt pain and then enter opioids, and what happened from that point?
Well, back in the 60s, we didn't have a whole lot of information about pain pathways, and the basic idea was that you analgesics, which were the non-opioids and the opioids in general, you could use the non-opioids, but don't use the opiate medications because they're bad medications. They can get addiction that can develop easily with those. And
so back in the 60s, we knew that.
Right.
Wow. Okay.
And we still knew that, but in the middle 80s, there was a couple of articles that came out that showed that the risk for opioid addiction was significantly lower, especially if you use them appropriately for pain control. The problems tended to be with people that abuse the medications or other medications, and they were at a significantly higher risk. The other thing was that we started to get an idea that pain was, by the 90s, we were hearing that pain was something that should be treated. You shouldn't worry about the level of the dosing of the medication, because even though you were taking it appropriately and became dependent on the medicine, it was not necessarily an addiction because you're treating something properly. The problem with doing that is that the people that it kind of went out to everybody. At that time, probably less than 3% of medical schools taught more than 3 hours of analgesics and anesthetics and pain management at all. And so the vast majority of physicians who are supposed to know what they're doing with regard to the medications didn't really have any idea of what the dangers were, how to use it chronically, and they started to give it. That developed into people that saw there was a benefit for people would come for these medications, and it was easily able to make a lot of money very quickly if you set up something like pill mills and things of that sort.
Physician friend of mine who suggested, opined, if you will, that maybe part of this is because of a fifth vital sign that was developed in terms of pain index, and I think we've all seen it with the smiley face going to the frowny face, 1 to 10. And also, some doctors and some facilities giving doctors a bonus when it comes to patient satisfaction if the numbers are up there. And what better way to keep a patient satisfied than give them something like Dilaudin if they say they're not feeling well? Doctor, what would you say to all of that? Is that just anecdotal, or is there any evidence to prove that that might have led to the problem we have today?
I don't know that it led to the problem. The thing that we had was that there was a beginning wave of understanding that opiate medications seem to be less of addictive problems if used properly. That really gave way to the thought that patients really, if it's less addictive in the proper settings, the people that have pain should be able to have that and that have pain control. That was coupled with the fact that the accrediting agencies for the hospitals said that patients have a right to pain management, and therefore we all physicians needed to be aware of and cognizant of patients' pain and suffering. So we were pushed to ask for that as a fifth, and the fifth vital sign came out as a result of that. In an effort to try to provide the best care that we could for people, it's very difficult for pain because it's a subjective modality. It's a subjective system. So there's no sticker that you put on the forehead that says, oh, you have a six-level pain or you have a seven-level pain. People need to be able to communicate with the physician for telling them how their pain level is, but they need to do more than that. Folks didn't have as much time as they should take to be in to work with the patients and learn from them, so they didn't spend the time to do more than tell me what's your problem. I have pain. Oh, how bad is it? Oh, it's real bad, doc. And then you'd give them medication because that was what was being produced. The FACES scales were important because the whole spectrum of people, from pediatrics to geriatrics, needed to have some way to try to communicate, and it wasn't always as good as it could be. So I think that it played a role in it from a perspective of more people were doing it. They didn't have the training for it. They didn't really spend the time to do what they needed to do to do a proper assessment. And a lot of people got medications that shouldn't have from well-meaning physicians that were trying to do the best they could to do that, to do something for them.
I'm sorry, doctor. We got good news here in a second. I know you've agreed to spend the hour with us, and we appreciate it. And the questions are pouring in at 870-870. So if you want to ask the doctor something, please send them in to us. Quickly, though, when it comes to that, and I don't mean to dwell on this, that pain scale with the smiley face and the frowny face, even if you're not looking for an opioid, would that in some way, for example, if I'm a patient and the pain's really a 2 and I'm looking at the scale and the pain's not that bad, but it's a nuisance, then I'm going to go ahead and say 10, not necessarily looking for an opioid, but it's like, you know what, I'm here, I may as well make that 2 go away.
Mm-hmm. One of it is the expectations are not well learned. We don't learn about pain as we're growing up very well and how to describe it. The thing about working with a physician when you're trying to get something treated is that you have to be as honest as you can be with them, too, so that you don't get undertreated, you don't get overtreated. And if you're going to have a level 2 pain, you look at the scale and you think you have a level 2 pain, don't go to 10, because you're going to the source for the information, and now we're looking at something that's a little bit more serious. We have to look into things, and you may or may not get an opiate for that, but it's something where we're bad information in is going to get bad results out.
Somebody texted in and said, I and Tommy Dennis must also take the opioid course before the end of 2018 in order to renew their licenses. Dr. Gould is one of the presenters at the continuing education course I'm attending tomorrow. So, doctor, what are some of the things you would be telling dentists or physicians as it relates to continuing education and what they need to learn vis-a-vis opioids?
Well, the problem initially starts with people that get medications that really don't need to have them. So the choice of medications to give, but docs actually think of analgesics, and when that happens, they think of either anti-inflammatory medications, aspirin, acetaminophen, or an opiate. And if it's something that seems to be, they anticipate it's going to be a strong pain problem, they'll provide the opiate medication, even though many times it's not the appropriate medication for what's happening or what's going to be needed. So what I'm going to try to convey to the dentist is don't eliminate the opiates from your armamentarium, because sometimes it's going to be necessary. But what they need to do is initially assess the patient properly, determine what it is that is going to be the primary reason that they're going to have pain, and then provide the medication that is appropriate for that problem. Not all pain is not just one entity. There's nerve pain. There's pain that's associated with inflammation. There's pain that's just intractable, that it's too strong to deal with, and you have to deal with that typically more with the opiates. But something like dental pain, which most of the time is either nerve-related and it doesn't respond to opiates, or it's an inflammatory process in a confined space that causes a lot of pressure and pain, and in that case, an anti-inflammatory medication is much more appropriate than an opiate.
In terms of continuing education, I heard this yesterday on Channel 4 from Vincent Collada, MD, Executive Director of the Louisiana State Board of Medical Examiners, and it kind of surprised me. This is what he had to say.
It used to be you could give opioids for a few days without any trouble. Then it's gotten to the point now some of these people are addicted within 2 days.
That's amazing to me, Dr. Harry Gould, that somebody can be addicted to something in as little as 2 days, but it happens.
Yes, it does. And the part of what we need to assess in before giving medications is to determine the risk that people have for potential addiction. A lot of people can go, it takes about 18 days to become dependent on the medication, so that you have to wean it off when you're finished using it. And a lot of those people won't have any problem with the opiate. The problem comes in is if you have some genetic predisposition, you have past history that puts you in a group where this is going to be more dangerous for the patient to provide it, then we probably shouldn't be providing it.
In terms of, before we run out of time, doctor, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but you are the director of the Pain Mastery Program at LSU Health New Orleans. What are some of the alternatives to opioids when it comes to mastering pain?
We use a lot of non-pharmacologic modalities. There's imagery, there's biofeedback, there are any cold presses, warm presses, massage. There's a number of things that we do. I look at 24 hours If you have pain, you have 24 hours to deal with it. If it's 24, if it's constant, if you can be able to get people to relax and get to sleep for 6 hours, then you only have to deal with the 18 hours that are left, and so on. So we do, a lot of people do well with physical activity. They get into activities for diversion. A lot of pain, cancer patients with pain have a significantly lower pain level if they are working with a group to help other people with their same problem.
Hmm.
So it's how we utilize our thinking about it, trying to redirect people's thoughts away from pain, and it's not easy to do. Sometimes you need a little bit of analgesic to be able to get them over that hump. But I think that the people that do the very best are the ones that are looking, that really don't want to have the medications, but they need to get their life back. And we call it the Pain Mastery Center, because when people come to a pain center, they think they're going to get their pain to go away. Now, that's unrealistic. And it's best if you don't have, you do have some pain, because it's a survival modality, prevents you from getting injured as much as you might otherwise. So what we try to do is take the patient's the pain being the controller of their life and switch it over so they're the controller of their life, irrespective of what pain that they have.
The Master, thank you, sir. I'm sorry we don't have more time, and I hope you can come back on with us.
Please.
Very
Thanks
informative.
For asking. Enjoyed being there.
Thank you, sir. So right back at you. Dr. Harry Gould, professor of neurology, director of the Pain Mastery Program at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s?
It's better over here.
Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.